Okay, excellent. Welcome, everybody. This is the Iran Brooks Show. We're broadcasting from London, England again. I'm still going to be here for another few days. Tomorrow's show will also be from my hotel room in London, England. A couple of things I want to do today. I've still got some Patreon questions that I've been asked in the past that I haven't got to, so I want to go through a couple of those, and we'll do that in a minute. I also want to just update something that I that we talked about yesterday about trade. I thought it'd be worth just I looked up kind of who are the big importers. Who do we import steel from, right? So the president, President Trump, constantly talks about the evil that is China and the evil that is trade with China. And the implication is that the tariffs that he's imposing are going to primarily restrict trade from China, and China's this evil country. And then I get a lot of comments online saying, well, but China subsidizes its steel industry. China dumps cheap steel in the United States. China has slave labor. China is an enemy. Don't you believe in restricting trade from countries that use slave labor? Now, all of this is bogus. All of this is nonsense. But what's really, really interesting, and to show how nobody out there defending Donald Trump has actually looked at the facts and actually knows what they're talking about, is the fact that China is not even one of the top 10 exporters of steel to the United States. That's right. Not even one of the top 10. We import from China less than 5% of the steel we import. Number one is Canada. The evil Canadians, the slave labor in Canada is the uncompetitive Canadians. The Canadians, they're the problem in the world, and long thought the Canadians were problematic. They are the problem in the world, and they're the ones we need to inhibit because what? Because we can't compete with them. Because in this case, Canada's making steel cheaper than the U.S. Who cares? Great, that's great. So we can get steep steel, cheap steel. Number two, Brazil. Number three, South Korea, another ally. Number four, Mexico. Number five, I found interesting that we import more steel from Russia than we do from China. So what's this whole China stuff? Aluminum, number one country from which we import aluminum is Canada again. Number two is Russia. Number three is United Arab Emirates. That's an interesting one. I need to figure out where that comes from. How come United Arab Emirates? And number four is China. Oh, wait, so China shows up some way on the lists. But it's pretty astounding given how much of the conversation is dedicated to China, how little we actually import from China is fascinating. And it's relating, in my view, it relates to this idea about Donald Trump. I mean, a big part of what Donald Trump's presidency or Donald Trump's character is about is the demonization of the other, is the creation of an enemy, of a foe, of somebody to be hated, somebody to be resented, somebody to be feared, somebody to be attacked. I mean, again, not that Donald Trump is a fascist, but this is exactly what fascists and authoritarians and dictators always do. They create an enemy. And in this case, China serves that purpose. And in terms of his economic nationalism, China is the villain. And therefore, everything is blamed on China, even though in this case, China has nothing to do with the massive amount of steel that we import into the United States. It's the fact that people in other countries, including Canada and Mexico and South Korea, make steel a lot cheaper than we do in the United States. It's at least some types of steel. We're still one of the largest producers of steel in the world. Now, part of the confusion comes from the fact that China produces 49% of all the steel in the world, but very little of that steel shows up in the U.S. What happens to most of that steel? Well, most of that steel gets consumed by the Chinese. They are, most steel in the U.S. gets consumed for construction. Well, guess what they're doing a lot of in China? They're building lots of buildings, skyscrapers. Lots of steel goes into construction. Of course, they also manufacture many goods, just like in the U.S. and the rest of this, and their steel goes into that. They also export to certain countries, but they do not, it turns out, export very much steel to the United States. I mean, I know that doesn't matter to most of you because nothing Donald Trump does, it can be bad, but I thought a few facts would be interesting to add to the discussion. So, again, I think if you really look at it, all of this hysteria about China is really, really driven by the need of a leader to have an enemy, the need of a leader who leans authoritarian to blame the other for any failings that we might have. You need a demon. You need somebody to blame all your ills on. And domestically, that is illegal immigrants, or more broadly, immigrants. And internationally, that is China, trade with China. Now, as I documented yesterday, he's also had some pretty bad things to say about trade with Canada, stupidly enough. But, so I just thought some facts. That'd be good. So you can look it up. Look up. That's what I did. Import steel to the U.S. There's some conflicting statistics. Not all the tables have exactly the same numbers. My guess is different years see differences in terms of imports. But the one uniform that you see across all the different tables that you look at is that Canada's number one and that China tends to be number 10 or number 11 in importing steel to the United States. And, a lot of the steel is being produced in Mexico and Canada because of NAFTA, because, NAFTA has provided some fantastic free trade, some dramatic lowering of tariffs, and it's turned out to be far more productive to produce steel in Canada and in Mexico than in the US. And I wouldn't be surprised if even some American companies have shifted production of some types of steel to those two countries. We import a huge quantity of steel. So I think, what's his name? Wilbur Ross said somewhere, oh, what was every campaigning about? It's only one penny, or it's only one whatever. It's small change. Yeah, but we import tons and tons and tons of steel. Multiply that by everything. These small changes make a massive difference to the cost of goods that are produced by steel. When you raise the price of steel by $25, that is a massive increase to consumers and a massive increase to producers who use steel to produce things. So construction goes up, the cost of construction, the cost of your home, the cost of building goes up. Ooh, the cost of living is high. What are we going to do? Yeah, cost of living is high because we place artificial barriers on the importation of cheap building products like steel. Automobiles, tractors, washing machines, a million other things are made with steel in them. A Caterpillar, think about Caterpillar suffering here. Right across the board, we are going to suffer dramatically. All right. Let us see. Yeah, it's kind of funny. Somebody wrote here, some industries only use U.S. steel. U.S. still produces about 5% of all the steel in the world, so it still produces quite a large quantity of steel in some localities. And I think Donald Trump passed some regulation at some point, for all those who think he deregulates all the time, passed a regulation that the government projects can only use U.S. steel, even if the steel, I guess, is not suitable. You've got to prefer the U.S. steel, even if it's more expensive. So somebody says that in Florida, I guess there's a bridge code that says you have to use U.S. steel to build bridges. It's so barbaric. It's so stupid. And I'm in the land here in the U.K. of Adam Smith, who wrote The Wealth of Nations to dispel this kind of nonsense almost 250 years ago. And yet, here we go again. We don't learn a thing. It took England about 70 years really to absorb the teachings of Adam Smith until the Corn Laws of the 1860s, I think, until they established true free trade, and bam, the benefits were immediate. It's taken the United States a long time to learn the benefits of free trade. Early in American history, we had a lot of trade barriers, and I think the growth of the United States was significantly hampered by the fact that we had protectionist policies early in the history of the United States. It's only really since World War II have the US and other Western countries identified the massive benefits of free trade and try to bring those principles to the world as a whole, and in a sense try to get other countries to adopt those same principles. And the tragedy is that we are now reverting back to barbarism. All right, well, to pre-knowledge economics, to pre-wealth of nations. Okay, I've said tons about trade. I've gone through the process. If you're interested in more, just go to YouTube and put your Ron Brook Trade, or go to Blog Talk Radio or your podcasting app where all my podcasts are listed, and look for trade in the title of some of my podcasts. I've done a lot on this. This is one of the issues that gets me most upset, because Donald Trump is the fact that he supports it is one thing, but the fact that so many people support him, the fact that so many people defend his position on trade is just to me mind-boggling in its irrationality. But there you go. All right. So one of the things that happens if you support me on Patreon is, I think if you give me more than $25 a month, and that's a really nice contribution, that's like $300 a year. So all of you who give me that amount, and there's a large group of you, thank you for doing that. If you do that, you can actually then propose topics for me to discuss on the show. And then those, I think, who give above, I think everybody else basically can vote on which ones, which topics I should discuss on the show. Now, the topic that won the day in for February was a topic I discussed on my first show from London, but we had technical difficulties, so I could only discuss the one topic and never got to the others. And that was on personal values versus whims. Hopefully you found that discussion worthwhile. I think it's an important discussion. It's an important point. And if any of you have follow-up questions on that discussion of personal values, whims, and moral values, moral principles, please ask more questions about this. This is crucially important. If I didn't answer everything you want answered on this, ask again. These kind of self-help, these kind of how to live the philosophy questions, in some ways are far more important to me than the political questions, although most of the stuff that people ask is political, as you'll see in a minute. So I'm happy to answer kind of the how to apply objectivism in my personal life type questions. So please do so. And again, if you're supporting on Patreon, that should be easy. You can also ask questions by emailing them to me, or it's just that Patreon people get priority, or by asking them on the chats, on the various chats. Although my internet connection for these shows in the UK is not very good. So what I cannot do is actually film this and monitor the chats, because the chats are sticky. They don't refresh constantly, although the chat in on YouTube is much better than the chat on Facebook. All right, so let's get to the questions. So today is going to be mostly politics, because these questions, well, two of the questions are politics, and then a couple are not. We'll see how much we get done, and if we get to how many of the questions we get to. Here's the question. The UN and others often regard Israel as an immoral aggressor in dealing with the Palestinians. What facts lead them to draw this conclusion? What is your response? So let me first say that there's actually a book coming out on the whole question of Israel and the appropriate United States position, the appropriate individual's position, your position as an individual should be towards Israel and the Palestinian case. So I strongly encourage everybody to order that book. I will be putting it up on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and other places. I'll probably be interviewing the author, Ilan Giono, on the show soon to discuss the book, at least once it's up on in Amazon for pre-order, because I hope all of you will go out there and buy the book and help make it a bestseller. You know, it's getting terrific endorsements from a lot of Middle East scholars, some people who really know the Middle East, and it's a terrific book and an important book on an important issue and an illustration of how to apply the objectivist principles to foreign policies. So that, I think, is the most important thing in terms of objectivism. It shows the world how you apply the principles of individual rights, of capitalism, of the proper role of government, but more importantly, of the morality of self-interest. How do you apply those principles to the questions of foreign policy? How to evaluate a foreign country, how to evaluate certain actions of a foreign country in relations to other individuals in the world. So strongly encourage all of you to get that book when it comes out, when it becomes available for pre-order, and you'll know that because I will advertise it. All right, so the UN and others regard Israel as an immoral aggressor. Well, what are the facts that lead them to draw this conclusion? I think that one has to conclude when one studies the Israeli-Palestinian conflicts that at the end of the day, there are no facts that lead them to this conclusion. The dominant fact that leads people to be anti-Israel, the dominant fact is the fact that Israel is strong, that Israel is a powerful country, that Israel is a wealthy country, that Israel is a successful country, that Israel is a country that protects the individual rights of its own citizens, and as a consequence, as a thriving economy, it's a country where individual rights, to the extent that they are protected in any Western country, are protected in Israel, and it is a civilized country. On the other hand, among the Palestinians, the Palestinian Authority is a rights violating government from beginning to end. It is a government that is based its entire legitimacy on the use of force, or illegitimacy on the use of force. It treats its people badly. Its people, therefore, are relatively poor, although not as poor as some in other Arab countries because of their relationship with Israel. They benefit enormously from having trade relationships, and some of them actually working in Israel. Basically, the story of Israel versus the Palestinians is the hatred of the strong and the adoration of the weak. This is what altruism, this is what the morality of altruism necessitates from you. And I often tell the story of Israel in before 1967. Before 1967, Israel was a country that was adored by Europeans, for example. It was a country that was seen as this struggling, in a sense, pathetic country with a lot of weak Jews who had somehow survived the Holocaust and were building something in the desert. But they were weak, and you felt sorry for them. And the Holocaust, of course, the Holocaust during World War II caused people to really feel sorry for them, and these were pathetic, weak Jews. We saw them walking into the gas chambers under the Nazis. Now, finally, they had a country, and somehow they were surviving. And yeah, they had won a couple of wars, barely, but here they were, and they were putting something together, and people admired them. And then in June of 1967, Israel was attacked. Basically attacked. Israel had to initiate a preemptive war because the Arab seven Arab countries were massing troops on the Israeli border, primarily the Egyptians, and that's where the war began. The Egyptians amassed troops on the Israeli border, ready to invade Israel, and the world was pretty sure Israel would be wiped out. If you've ever seen a map of Israel, it is tiny. The Arabs outnumber, in terms of sheer numbers, Israel by massive quantities. Israel in those days had a population of about 2 million people, maybe three. I think it was closer to two. Arab countries had tens and millions of people. Their armies were larger. The Egyptian army was backed by the Russians and had the latest Russian tanks and the Russian equipment. Israel, an unknown fact, very few people know, is that Israel had in those days no American weapons. America had instigated a embargo on selling weapons to Israel from 1948 until 1967. So Israel had no American weapons. It basically had French airplanes and old British tanks and German weapons and other weapons, but nothing American, right? So relatively second rate weaponry. Here were all these countries allied again, and within 6 days, called the Six-Day War, Israel crushed them. It didn't just defeat them. It crushed them in 6 days. It completely wiped out the Egyptian army, driving them to the Suez Canal. It completely annihilated the Egyptian Air Force, mostly on the ground with a preemptive strike to their Air Force. Then the Israelis begged. At the same time, as soon as the war started with the Egyptians, with the preemptive strikes, the Syrians attacked in the north of Israel. Now, Syria is like an hour drive from Haifa. They could have gotten to the population centers of Israel quickly. Israel held them back, drove up the Golan Heights in spite of everything, and pushed them back and occupied the Golan Heights. Israel then begged the Jordanians not to intervene, but the Jordanians did intervene anyway. And as a consequence, the war was expanded to an eastern front, where ultimately the Israelis pushed back the Jordanians and occupied all the land between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean. So, Israel won a big, massive, huge, unexpected, unpredictable victory and came out of the Six-Day War as this incredible power in the Middle East. And the consequence of that is that the West suddenly looked at these Jews, suddenly looked at the state of Israel and said, "Whoa, these aren't pathetic Jews. These aren't poor Jews. These aren't weak Jews. These Jews are powerful. They just won a war in 6 days against all these countries. We hate them. We don't like powerful Jews. We don't like powerful anything. We certainly don't like powerful Jews. We hate them." Now, who should we feel sorry for? There must be a victim. If there's a successful people, if somebody's successful, then there must be a victim. And they found the Palestinians, and they turned them into the victim, and they created a whole victim mythology around the Palestinians. But the truth is, historically, that from the time that the first Jews came to Palestine, or the Jews, some Jews, the new Jews came, the Jews came to Palestine in the late 19th century, bought land, cultivated it, built industries, built an electric grid, created civilization in the swamps of Israel. Since that time, the Arab population has been hostile to their attempts to bring progress. Since that time, the Arab population has attacked them, tried to murder them, tried to kill them, tried to steal their land, and tried to steal their property. The initiator force, the aggressor from the beginning of time, have been the Palestinians. Now, is everything Israel's done good and right and just? Absolutely not. I mean, in many regards, Israel is a mixed economy like any other mixed economy, and therefore has real flaws. But even with regard to the Palestinians, have Israelis made mistake with regard to the Palestinians? Has their policy been mistaken? Sure. Have they committed, during wars, maybe here and there, atrocities? Sure. But in comparison to what the Palestinians have done, and in comparison to the way almost every military has acted throughout human history, Israel are angels in comparison. So, by every standard, by the standard of protection of individual rights, the Israelis are the good guys and the Palestinians are the bad guys. By the standard of who initiated force and who continues to use force, and who tr the Israelis are the good guys and the Palestinians are the bad guys. If the standard is who vies for peace more, who tries to bring about peace, who insists on going to the negotiating table, who offers the greatest compromises, whether that's a virtue or not, you decide, but offers the greatest compromises, Israel is virtuous, the Palestinians are not. Think about how many times, if you know anything about the negotiations between the Israelis and the Palestinians, the Israelis gave the Palestinians 90% of what they wanted, and the Palestinians turned them down. Constantly, over and over and over again, the Israelis begged for peace. "Please accept our suicidal, crazy terms so that we can pretend to ourselves that we won't have a war." And the Palestinians, in their utter stupidity, said no. So, altruism drives us to view the victor, the powerful, the strong, the able, the good, the productive, as negative. and the weak, the meek, the pathetic, the aggressors, the poor as virtuous. There are no facts. There are no facts that would lead one to the conclusion that Israel is a bad, immoral aggressor and the Palestinians are worth dealing with. Now, the questioner asks about the UN. Now, I have to admit that I don't care about what the UN regards. I consider the UN an inherently immoral institution. The UN is inherently anti-life, anti-man, anti-values, anti-freedom. The UN is a despicable institution, an institution that places at the same moral level playing field Israel, who are basically the good guys, in Syria and Libya, which, you know, where there's people are slaughtering one another, and Saudi Arabia, where women cannot drive or cannot hold significant economic positions, and where gay people are thrown off of tall buildings because they are not tolerated, and where adultery is punished with stoning to death. And yet they get both countries, Saudi Arabia and Israel, get a seat at the same table. I don't grant that. There is no same table. There's no seat at the table for for the kind of immorality that a Saudi Arabia or Libya or even a Russia today represent. You know, the fact that Russia and China and the United States all have veto power as if they are equal partners, as if there's something similar, particularly when Russia was part of the Soviet Union, was horrifically murdering tens of millions of people. They sat at the same table of the United States with the same rights to veto everything out of the UN. The UN, from its beginning, from day one, was an immoral, horrible, horrible institution. So I don't take anything as anything relating to the UN seriously or to be quoted. So the fact that the UN thinks that the Israelis are the bad guys and the Palestinians are the good guys should at least give you some indication that it's probably the other way around. The UN has 222 countries, 200 of which I probably don't care one iota what they think. All right. Again, you know, if you want more specific questions about Israeli-Palestinian conflict, feel free to ask me. There will be this book coming out by Ilan Juneau. But I know a lot about this conflict. I know a lot about the history. Please feel free to follow it up with other questions and other comments. And if you disagree, feel free to put comments down in the comments below. And by the way, if you're on YouTube right now, I know some people on YouTube, subscribe to my channel. Most of you are probably subscribed, but it turns out that about 50% of the people watching the videos are not subscribed. Go subscribe, so you know that way you'll get notifications when I have a show on, and you'll know when I've posted something new. And it'll be great to have you as part of our team here. Also, those of you who like what I do on these shows, please go to Patreon and support the show. Patreon.com/IranBrooksShow. You can also make kind of a one-time contribution on PayPal.me/IranBrooksShow, so you can make kind of one-time contributions to the show that way. And I encourage you to do so and support the efforts that we're making, not just for these shows, but for the trips I do here in the UK and other places around the world, explaining Ayn Rand's ideas, bringing Ayn Rand's ideas to young people. Okay, let's see. There's one other question. Yeah, this one is a kind of a factual, technical question, but related to kind of the trade issues that are going on right now, so I wanted to cover it. This is from Ron. Explain why Nixon closed the gold window, claiming the trade deficit was causing unacceptable gold outflows to countries we had a trade deficit with. How can we measure the percent of such gold outflow that was due to currency inflation rather than due to any trade deficit? Or is any of the gold outflow attributable to the trade deficit? Okay, so there's a lot of interesting issues that this question brings up. I want to talk about what happened under Nixon, coming out of kind of the gold standard that came out of Bretton Woods, out of the Bretton Woods Agreement, I think was signed in 1944, post that really was the way in which monetary policy was managed in the world post World War II, up until 1971, when Nixon took us off of the gold standard and closed what's called the gold window. So I want to talk a little bit, I want to talk about that world and what that looks like and how, well, and then what that has to do with trade deficits, and we'll see not much because of the way it was structured. And then compare that to a world in which there is a real gold standard, a true gold standard, a gold standard that is not a government-run, a central banking-run gold standard, but a private bank gold standard. And then look at gold flows, because then you would see gold flowing because of trade deficits going out and in. But it also has interesting implications to prices of goods in your home country. So I want to talk about those two. And I think that's all I'm going to talk about today, because I'm actually going to see a play tonight. So I'm taking advantage of being in a epicenter of culture, which is London. I love London, partially because there's so much to do. I could have gone to a different classical. I mean, tomorrow I think there's a classical concert. There's like a piano recital in the morning. There's something in the early afternoon. There's something in the late afternoon. There's something in the evening. So tonight I'm going to see an Oscar Wilde play. Which is always a treat. I love Oscar Wilde. He's incredibly funny, observant, smart, witty. The English call it witty. And then tomorrow, I'm going to see a recital by a violin and piano recital with oh my God, what's his name? I'll tell you in a minute. A famous young violinist, relatively young. I guess everybody's young. As I get older, everybody becomes younger. Who's a real fabulous violinist. And that will be tomorrow. Anyway, yeah, Joshua Bell, who I've seen before, and he's a wonderful, young violinist. I'm going to see him, and that's going to be a blast. And yeah, so I'm taking advantage a little bit of London culture. London culture. I love classical music, for those of you who don't know. I love the theater, particularly kind of the classic plays. I would have loved to go and see, I guess, a Shakespeare play, but nothing that is about really looked that interesting to me. Anyway. All right. Let's see. So I was talking about Nixon. So let's see. So this is how Bretton Woods kind of set it up. And so this is what US monetary policy was guided by going into the 1970s. So the idea was this: the idea that all currencies in the West, so this is France and England and in the US and ultimate, would be. No, sorry, that the US currency, which was going to be the reserve currency of the world, it was going to be the currency by which all other currencies were measured. The idea of Bretton Woods that the US currency would be pegged to the dollar at a fixed exchange rate. So you could exchange dollars for gold at a fixed exchange rate, right? And this, the idea was, this would create a stable anchor for economic growth globally during this period post-World War II, when the world needed to be rebuilt, and it needed an anchor, it needed stability in the world. Now, it always needs stability, it always needs an anchor, so it's unfortunate the way off a gold standard. But we'll get to this particular gold standard was a bad gold standard. So they pegged the dollar. I don't remember what amount was exchangeable into gold, but a particular amount of dollars would always be interchangeable into an ounce of gold. Now, this is the thing. At the time when Bretton Woods was passed, Americans were barred from owning gold. It was illegal for Americans to own gold. Indeed, in 1933, people don't remember this, don't know this, don't study this in history. But in 1933, FDR confiscated, imagine somebody trying to do this today, confiscated all the gold in the United States of America from private hands. He barred made it illegal, with a few exceptions of a few coins, to own gold by individual citizens or by private companies. The only ones who could who had the gold was the Federal Reserve, basically Fort Knox, the U.S. Treasury, Federal Reserve. They had all the gold. He also, so in 1944, basically, they said, look, American citizens will still be barred from owning gold. It will still be illegal for Americans to own gold. So that when we say we're pegging the dollar to gold, it's not to allow Americans to exchange their dollars into gold. No, Americans will not be allowed to own any gold. And indeed, it was illegal to hold gold in the United States until the 1970s, until Nixon went off the gold standard and eliminated the restriction to owning gold. But other countries, other governments, other central banks, they can exchange the dollars into gold. So they have the ability to go to the U.S. Treasury or to go to the Federal Reserve and say, here are the dollars. We want gold in exchange. We want gold in exchange. All right, so this system kind of worked okay. What generally happened is the gold all sat at Fort Knox. And very rarely did anybody ask that their dollars be exchanged into gold because inflation was relatively stable. And so you're preserving the paper value of your money, even though so it was fixed to gold, but the Fed was cheating, but it wasn't cheating a lot, it was cheating a little bit. It was printing additional dollars more than they could exchange into gold. But it wasn't cheating a lot. So in a sense, if you think about it, let me see if I can. So it was fixed, but they were printing more money than there was gold. So what should have happened to the value of those dollars in terms of gold? It should have gone down. That is, the value of the dollar bill should have steadily gone down relative to gold, because the quantity of gold was fixed, relatively fixed, right? And the amount of dollars was increasing faster than the amount of gold. So slowly what was happening was the gold was worth more than the dollars at this fixed exchange rate. Now, in the 1950s and most of the 1960s, this was no big deal, because the growth of the dollar, the inflation, the reduction in the value of the dollar was relatively small, so that countries didn't mind. And what would happen is dollars flowed, because we would buy things from France. The French would buy stuff from us, you know, so there would be trade. If the French landed up with extra dollars, they would invest in the United States. But often during this period of time, the United States was an exporter, because most of these countries had almost nothing, right? They had nothing to sell. They had been eviscerated, destroyed during World War II. So the United States was investing in Germany, in France, in England with dollars, right? Then those dollars were used by the French and British and Germans to buy American goods, because, you know, that's all they had. Now, this was starting to change in the late 1960s. Two things were happening. One is the United States was starting to import more from these countries, because these countries were getting stronger economies. And these economies now had more dollars. And or had dollars from imports, from exporting rather than just from investment. But in addition, what was happening in the late 1960s is inflation was picking up. And now the value of the dollar was declining faster and faster and faster. And now, the if you exchange the dollar bills that you had in your pocket for gold, the gold was worth much more than the dollar bills that you had in your pocket. Much more. Now, American citizens couldn't do that. They were at a huge disadvantage. So you didn't have a choice. You just had the paper that was depreciating in value, and you suffered from the inflation going forward. But foreign governments had the potential to exchange dollars into gold. and to take all that gold out because the gold was worth more than the dollar bills. Now, the United States spent a lot of effort trying to convince governments not to do this. Because most governments around the world that the United States was doing business with were allies of the United States, most of those governments decided not to withdraw gold from, in a sense, Fort Knox in exchange for the dollars. In other words, not to recognize in global markets the fact that the dollar had been depreciating in value dramatically, but to accept the fixed exchange rate and to keep the dollars in a sense, and to absorb themselves the inflation that was associated with those dollars. The fact that the dollar was worth less and could buy less stuff, and that you would rather really hold the gold at the fixed exchange rate. Except for one country and one political leader. The late 1960s were a time of renewed French nationalism under Charles de Gaulle. For a variety of reasons that had to do with internal French politics, Charles de Gaulle wanted to establish himself as independent from the United States. If you remember, he withdrew from NATO. He established his own nuclear deterrence. He wanted to present himself and France as independent of America and as free of American influence. It helped him, I think, with the student rebellion, or at least I think he thought it helped him with the student rebellion of 1968. But generally, France was on this course of, we're not going to be seduced by the communists, but we're not going to be seduced by the Americans either. We don't want to be a part of this global fight over, over communism versus the American form of capitalism. We don't like the Americans. We don't like the Soviets. We're gonna have our own path into the future. And as a part of this, is Charles de Gaulle refused to accept inflated dollars. So the French started systematically exchanging their dollars for gold. And what you started seeing was a systematic outpouring of gold, primarily in the direction of France. Now, this upset the United States. Americans weren't happy. The American government wasn't happy. And the fear was that people would lose confidence in the dollar and its peg to gold, and that there would be a run on gold, that everybody in the world, all these foreign governments, again, individual citizens couldn't do this, that foreign governments would run on gold and all the gold in America would basically flow overseas. Again, not because of an import-export imbalance, it had nothing to do with that, but because of inflation, because the dollar was worth less and less and less in terms of gold. There you go. That's why Nixon decided to go off the gold standard. Now, he could have done a lot of things. He could have, for example, allowed individual citizens to exchange dollars for gold. He could have changed the gold peg. He could have readjusted it and forced the Federal Reserve to stop printing money like crazy, but quite the opposite. Not only did he go into off the peg to gold, he basically let the dollar float and encouraged the Federal Reserve to print many more dollars. And we went into a period in the 1970s of relatively, in the United States, hyperinflation. Much of the rest of the world went into real hyperinflation. But we went into a situation where we had massive amounts of inflation. And now the dollar wasn't pegged to anything. There was no constraint on the Federal Reserve from printing as much as it wanted. It created huge amounts of printed currency. And the United States during the late 1970s had stagflation. We had a recession plus inflation, stagnation plus inflation. And it was a dark, horrible, really, really bad period for the US economy during the 1970s. So Bretton Woods was a flawed system, a dramatically flawed system, primarily because it did not ultimately restrict the Federal Reserve from printing money. So the Federal Reserve printed money no matter whether it had gold reserves or not. The Federal Reserve printed money way above and beyond of the gold that it actually had in its vaults. As a consequence, you had inflation, the value of the dollar plummeted, and people got foreign governments wanted to hold gold instead of dollars. So that's kind of the history. And again, it had nothing to do with trade deficits. Now let's talk a little bit about what would happen, and then we're going to call it a day. What would happen in a true gold standard? So in a true gold standard, currency is issued by banks based on the amount of gold reserves that they have. Now, if you are buying, now let's pretend for a minute that there is no currency. Let's pretend that all money is gold. Literally, people buying and selling things with gold. And even our electronic money is all denominated in gold. Then, when I buy stuff from China, for example, I send them gold and get the stuff, right? So the amount of gold in the US, if you will, given everything held constant, everything else held constant, declines as gold leaves and goes to China. Now, China might decide to take that gold and invest it back in the United States by real estate, by I don't know, factories, by something in the United States. And in that case, the gold would flow back to the United States, or they might decide not to. They might decide to hold the gold in China. Gold doesn't depreciate in value, it keeps its value. So they might decide to hold the gold in China. Now, if they invest it in US-based assets, and the reason they invest in US-based assets is because then they can get a return on their investment. So it grows. When you actually only have gold, you're just keeping the purchasing power of your money. You're not actually increasing the value of what you hold. So likelihood is, as long as the United States has a robust economy, that the gold flows back in the form of investment in the United States. But let's assume it doesn't. Let's assume it flows over there. And let's assume we're running a massive trade deficit with the rest of the world, China and everybody else. So gold is flowing out. And let's assume that gold is not being reinvested back in the United States. Note that that is not the case today. The case today is that gold, the money, the equivalent, if you will, is flowing back into the United States as investment. But let's assume it doesn't. Let's assume it stays overseas. What would happen to the US economy? Well, what would happen to the US economy is that the quantity of money would shrink. Why would the quantity of money shrink? Because the quantity of gold has shrunk. Gold is money. So if banks issue currency based or distribute electronic money based on the amount of gold they have in the vaults, and the amount of gold in the vaults is shrinking, then the amount of money in the US economy is shrinking. That's called deflation. What would happen to prices if that were the case? Everything in a true laissez-faire economy, the prices would come down. What would happen to the price of labor? The price of labor would come down. And as a consequence, goods in America in terms of gold would become cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. And they would get to a point where they were so cheap that it would be worth the while for the Chinese to start buying American goods. Or for Americans not to send their gold to China to bring the goods here, but to buy American goods because American goods were now cheap enough so that they were just as cheap as the Chinese good, assuming China had this advantage in terms of goods. And so they would become cheap enough and labor would be cheap enough in the United States so that all these countries would start ex importing themselves from the US and sending the gold to the United States. The beauty of a gold system is that it is an amazing equilibrium creator, right? So if gold flows, prices adjust, gold will flow back. As long as you're producing, as long as there's freedom, as long as people are innovating, creating, building, making stuff, your economy will do fine, no matter whether you're importing or exporting, no matter whether people coming in or people leaving, as long as there's production happening. And production could be in many forms. It could be services, it could be real goods, it could be a variety of different things. The economy's function and the movement of currency, in this case gold, goes, happens relatively smoothly. Now, in a world particularly of electronic money, where it doesn't really matter where the physical gold is stored, all of this happens constantly and simultaneously. And as I said, the likelihood is in a world like today, that all that gold would flow back to the United States in a form of investment, just like all the dollars that go to China, all the dollars that go to Mexico, all the dollars that go to Canada, all the dollars that go to Europe, ultimately flow back into the United States in terms of foreign investment. And there's massive, massive, massive foreign investment in the United States. Who buys all our bonds? Who keeps our interest rates low? So we truly need trade deficits don't matter. No matter whether you're on a gold standard, no matter whether you're on a dollar standard, trade deficits in and of themselves don't matter. The problem today in the U.S. economy is that so much of our consumption is driven by debt. So much of what we spend, whether for importation or for whether domestic spending, is a consequence of borrowing money from the future. It's a consequence of issuing bonds. It's a consequence of mortgaging the future of our children. That's the problem. The problem isn't that we're importing a lot of stuff from foreign countries. The problem isn't that we're sending dollars over there. The problem is that we in the United States are borrowing too much money. And if a day comes where we actually have to pay that money back, it's going to be very, very difficult. And it's going to require real cuts in our own consumption, which could require real cuts in our standard of living, because we'll suddenly have to pay the piper. And that's the real danger. And that, again, has nothing to do with trade. It has everything to do with government policy and particularly government spending. We spend way, way too much. The government, the federal government in particular, but state governments, local governments, have promised and are spending much more than what they can afford. And that's the challenge. And that's something Donald Trump and Republicans are doing nothing, zero zilch about. Instead, they are focused on a non-problem, and by quote, trying to solve the non-problem, they're going to make the economy in the United States much worse. They're going to make the problems, the economic problems in the U.S. much worse. And because they're ignoring spending, everything is out of kilter, so that the crisis, when it comes, will be far more dramatic, far worse than it is today, far more damaging, truly destructive, much worse than 2008. Much worse than what we've experienced so far. So let's hope we can rebound somehow before that happens, but it's going to happen. We are setting ourselves up for disaster. All right. Thanks, everybody. I hope you enjoyed the show today. It's again, I'm broadcasting here from London. And thank you for following me on Facebook and Twitter on and don't forget to subscribe on YouTube. I'm going to go now to check how many of you subscribed on YouTube. I hope many of you have. And support the show on patreon.com/YaronBrookshow. And I will see you probably tomorrow, sometime during the day. I'm not sure exactly when. I will be talking to you tomorrow, and I will also try to do some shows during the week. We'll see how that works, depending on my fairly busy schedule here in London. But